I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The French government is charging the Bush administration with running a deliberate campaign of disinformation against France. In a striking J'accuse letter sent today to administration officials and members of Congress, the French ambassador, Jean-David Levite, alleges that the U.S. government has planted false news stories in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Washington Times. The letter says the reports, citing anonymous administration or intelligence officials, are part of an ugly campaign to destroy the image of France. According to the Washington Post, a senior Bush administration official has called the French charges utter nonsense. Patrick Giraud is bureau chief for the newspaper Le Monde in Washington, D.C. And welcome, Patrick.
Thank you for having me.
Can you run down, Patrick, the basic list of stories France says the Bush administration has planted?
The ambassador in his letter is listing several stories which appeared since September in various news media in the United States, and which are basically stories about the relationship between France and the Saddam Hussein regime in Iraq. And even for the last story after the fall of the regime, as you probably know, the Washington Times wrote that France had been providing dignitaries of the regime with French passports, which was, of course, denied by the French government.
Patrick, you've seen the French ambassador's letter. What's the tone of it?
Well, it's basically saying that French is libeled by stories which all of them are based on anonymous sources. So the French government is quite angry at the fact that some of these stories, at least, seem to come from government circles in Washington, and the U.S. government doesn't officially confirm these stories, but it doesn't either put an end to it.
We know the relations between the United States, the Bush administration, and France are frosty. But just how bad are relations between France and the United States now?
Well, I think that on a governmental level, the relation is not good. It's probably the first time that, at least in America, that the French ambassador or any other ambassador for that matter publishes such a letter to the American government and the news media accusing them of libel against his country. So probably it says something of the relationship of how bad it has become now, but it probably also says something about the way things are going over here on this kind of topics. I mean, it's quite unusual for a news organization, at least usually, to rely on anonymous sources. I think that what we have all learned in our journalism schools is that you've got to have sources for your stories, and these sources cannot be all, or at least not all of them, masked. And the point is that the news media over here are buying those stories in sometimes quite an, I would say, surprising and maybe an ethical way.
Very briefly, do you see any near-term change for the better in relations between France and the U.S.?
Well, we have had several times those discussions. Are you optimistic or pessimistic? I'm afraid I'm in the camp of the pessimist. I don't see how it could improve in the coming years. The opposition, the conflict which appeared about Iraq, is a broader conflict about the views of the modern times and of the world that are supported. Not only in France, I would say, in large part of Europe, but especially in France, as opposed to the views of this administration, which are obviously supported by a large part of the American public. So I rather side with the pessimists.
Patrick Giraud, thank you very much for joining us on Here and Now.
You're welcome.
Patrick Giraud is bureau chief for the newspaper Le Monde in Washington, D.C.
A six-member FBI team arrives in Saudi Arabia today to help the Saudi government investigate Monday's suicide attacks in Riyadh that killed at least 34 people, including eight Americans. The U.S. is reiterating that the team is in the country to assist in the investigation, not run it. But feelings are running high because of the nature of one American company in particular targeted by the attacks. Joining us on the line is Patrick Lang. He's former head of Middle Eastern Affairs at the Defense Intelligence Agency and the defense attaché at the American Embassy in Riyadh from 82 to 85. So, Mr. Lang, how cooperative do you think the Saudis will be with the FBI? In 1996, they limited U.S. access to suspects and evidence in that bombing of the Khobar Towers military dorm.
Yeah, I was thinking of that exactly myself. At the time, in testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee, I said that I didn't think they would be able to, the Saudis would find themselves able to cooperate with us on this matter, and they did not. There's a very strong bar in the culture to handing these people over to us to be punished by us. And in that case, as I recall, they actually found it necessary to execute them before it was possible for us, our people, to really talk to them. Mm.
But there is word that Saudis have been volunteering details, that the Saudi official TV station carried footage of the sites that were bombed, and that newspapers have even used the word terror.
Yeah, I think that's true. They're taking this a lot more seriously than they did in the past. And if you read Crown Prince Abdullah's statement, which was very strong in denouncing these people as, in fact, not true Muslims and people who were using Islamic scripture as justification for things that could not be excused, you could see that they find this to be a deeply disturbing thing for their own country. But whether or not they'll be able to go the extra mile in actually attacking this question the way the French or the Germans or the British or somebody would do in cooperation with us, I think, is probably a different matter.
Yeah. One of the targets of the bombing was the compound of the Vinnell Corporation. What exactly is Vinnell?
Vinnell is a private U.S. company that provides, in this case, military training to the Saudi Arabian National Guard. They've been doing this for maybe 25 years now under contract. That contract is administered by the U.S. Army Materiel Command, and Vinnell Corporation, using retired military people, Army and Marine, executes the training contract for about a three-brigade, it's about 20,000-man light-armored force of the Saudi National Guard.
Mm. Well, that raises a lot of questions. First of all, how is it that military security specialists didn't have their own compound secured? The guards didn't even have guns.
Those compounds are private enterprises that are run by companies in Saudi Arabia that provide housing to expatriate business people and people who work for companies like Raytheon, Vinnell, and people like that. So these are not government facilities. The one that is in which Vinnell was housed, however, had some Saudi Arabian National Guard soldiers involved. And I understand that, in fact, several of these fellows were gunned down by the attackers who were wearing Saudi National Guard uniforms when they broke in.
Ah, so they could have deceived them. Well, the other question is, many Saudis believe that Vinnell is a thinly veiled CIA outfit.
If you ask people in the Middle East, everything that looks in any way interesting is obviously a manifestation of the CIA. To tell you the truth, the Central Intelligence Agency is not competent to manage or carry out a program that involves a generation of an armored force of any kind. This is strictly an Army operation run by Army Materiel Command and under the direct supervision of Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia.
Mm. And yet it has ties to both Bush administrations. Several high-ranking members of at least the senior Bush administration serve on the board of Vinnell. Is it assumed that this company was struck directly as a strike against even the Bush administration?
And the company's contracts go well back before, concerning the National Guard, go well back before the era of the Bush administrations. So, I don't think that you can see that kind of connection. If you want to see this is being aimed at somebody in particular, I would look at Crown Prince Abdullah, since the Saudi National Guard is entirely his creature, his baby.
Mm. Well, the U.S. plans to downgrade its military presence in Saudi Arabia, close down bases. Do you see companies like Vinnell, with their huge defense contracts and former soldiers on staff, sort of becoming the replacement U.S. forces in Saudi Arabia?
Well, Vinnell has never had anything to do with anything except the National Guard, and in fact, only a fairly small portion of the National Guard, which is what Vinnell advises and trains. The rest of the Saudi armed forces have been advised by an American military mission made up from the different U.S. armed forces. I think the advisory role is likely to continue to some extent, and I think certainly Bunnell will remain there. What's likely to move out are U.S. operating forces, air forces, use of headquarters facilities for our own operations, things like that. But I'd be surprised if the training relationship, especially that of Bunnell, is very much reduced.
Well, Patrick Lang, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Patrick Lang, former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency's Office of Middle Eastern Affairs.
In Iraq, several developments today, and here's an update. In Baghdad, Paul Bremer, the new U.S. administrator in charge of rebuilding the country, held his first news conference. He said coalition forces are cracking down on crime, arresting 300 Iraqis in the past 2 days.
But much of the crime is reportedly committed by remaining Ba'ath party members. Major General Buford Blunt III says some of the marauders aren't simply criminals. They're politically focused gunmen intent on attacking the coalition.
And while most of Iraq is still under coalition control, the southern port of Umm Qasr became the first town handed over to the Iraqi people. In a short ceremony today, British Lieutenant Colonel Peter Jones spoke to residents and to officials.
Personally, it's been a great pleasure working alongside you. We've had our ups and downs, but conditions are right now for you to take control and authority by yourself.
Elections will be held in the next couple of weeks. Naeem Abed Mahdi is one of 12 people currently serving on the town council.
I don't know how to explain my feeling, but I think I'm and we are very, very happy to be liberated first and to be ruled ourselves by ourselves, because it's the first time for more than 35 years.
Well, the Bush administration is pressing the UN Security Council for a vote early next week on a resolution that would lift sanctions on Iraq and permit the U.S. to export Iraqi oil. Speaking at a news conference in Bulgaria today, Secretary of State Colin Powell said that the oil money would be used for reconstruction.
The important thing is to be able to begin moving oil out of Iraq in due course in order to generate revenue for the Iraqi people to benefit them solely.
And remember that $1 billion Saddam Hussein's son was said to have made off with in the early morning hours before American troops entered Iraq? Well, American troops have found $950,000 stashed in boxes in several locations around Baghdad. U.S. Treasury officials believe it's the same money that was taken by the Hussein family, and they promise it will soon be transferred to the Iraqi Central Bank.
Just ahead, how liberated will women be in a new Iraq?
And later in the program, new government guidelines on blood pressure. You may not be as healthy as you think.
And finding serenity these days may seem like a tall order. We hear serenity poems from our listeners.
There's more coming up here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Romania's intelligence service says it foiled plans by Iraqis and other foreigners to attack targets in their country this spring. For more on that story, go to our website, WBUR.org, and click on news. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Bicon Dental Implants, offering patients a same-day solution for a failed root canal-treated tooth. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Faulkner Hospital, Bicon.com. By the Newman School, a small co-ed college prep school in the Back Bay, applications still being accepted for fall 2003 on the web at newmanboston.org. And by Mississippi's. Mississippi serves American, Caribbean, Italian, African, Asian, and South American food. In the forecast, partly sunny and breezy today, high 64 inland, a little cooler along the coast. Tonight looks cloudy, might obscure that total lunar eclipse.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Most Westerners might be surprised to learn that it was Saddam Hussein who decreed in the 70s that men and women should have equal rights, or that Iraqi women have long enjoyed freedoms in education, business, fashion, and politics. Most recently, women held 20% of the seats in Iraqi's parliament, as opposed to only 14% in the U.S. and 3.5% average in Arab states. But many women now worry that, ironically, Hussein's brutal secular regime might be replaced by an extremist Islamist government, which would force women back into their homes and into covering garments. Zainab Al-Zawaji is the director of the American Islamic Congress, and she recently returned from a visit to Baghdad as part of the U.S.-led reconstruction, where she's part of the move to revitalize the educational system. We met her at her Cambridge office, where we asked about a time when Iraqi women were the envy of the region.
That's right. That goes back to the early, even in the 50s. We have the first judge women in the Middle East, and we had many other women in very high positions in the government. And in recent days, we have Iraqi women in ministry, like, for example, in northern Iraq.
We know that the situation for women deteriorated greatly after 91 relative to how it was in the 70s and 80s. Sort of the economic impact was felt most by women. But how are women in Iraq feeling now? Is there some trepidation that sometimes the enemy that you know is better than the one you don't know, and at least Saddam Hussein had decreed equal rights, however corrupted that was. And we see the Shia Muslims celebrating in the streets. The Shia are the majority, and yet wouldn't they... what would that mean for women in Iraq if the Shia majority took power?
Well, even if we are talking about the Shia, the Shias are the majority, but not necessarily all Shiites are very religious or conservative. I doubt that Iraq is going to be an Islamic state, or even the Shiites, even if the Shiites rule the country, is not going to be in an extreme way.
And it's a hope of many, but is there also a fear that there might be some setbacks for women? We hear that the young women, for instance, are embracing the head coverings, and that there might be some step backwards.
I realize that increase that, for example, the head cover in the past probably 12-10 years. Not necessarily all the women who they are covering their head are, are only Shiites. So they could be Sunnis also.
And you are sitting with a beautiful head covering as we speak.
I am actually in my days when I started to cover, I was the only girl in my school of 400-500 who was covered. And in the 70s and 80s, head cover was something not people like.
Well, know. That's why I guess there's a fear that with Hussein gone, oddly enough, mm-hmm. there might be some setbacks for women, that the head covering might not be a choice, mm-hmm. that women might slowly be asked to stay at home.
I don't think that will happen. Iraq's situation is different than, for example, any other countries. Iraqis, most of them are very well educated. And women played a big role in the society. Women represent more than half of the society in Iraq. And when we are in Baghdad meeting, I spoke about women's role and how important it is and to have a voice in the parliament and in leadership in Iraq. After I finished my talk, many of them, even the sheikhs or of the tribes, or the head of the tribes, they came to me and they said that what you said is right. And many of the imams and the clergies there, they came and they said what you said is right. It's very important. It's very crucial to have women in politics and in the parliament and in leadership in Iraq.
You yourself have been charged with returning to the new post-Saddam Iraq to help reconstruct the education system there. Is there something that needs to be changed or fixed as regards women in the school systems?
Bringing women back to school, who they missed the opportunity during the past regime. This is a very important issue. A lot of ladies or women young girls, their families stop them from going to school because of safety issues.
What about the books and the literature? There's a joke around that the first thing everyone has to do is cut out the pictures of Saddam Hussein. You're nodding yes. But what next, and what for women?
That's right. The curriculum is really filled with messages to serve the propaganda of the regime. Even, for example, art, as beautiful as it is, you know, drawing or making things, drawing always they've been asking us to draw pictures from the war. As, you know, kids of 9, 10, 6, 7 years old, this is how they, you know, open their eyes, forgetting about all the beautiful things in the world and write or draw things about from the war. I grew up there and I went to school there. I saw what's the pressure that the kids have in school. I remember one of my friends, the day she graduated from being a teacher assistant, they told them, since you completed your courses, we're going to have a surprise for you. So they took them and they brought a few soldiers who they've been deserted from the army, and they shoot them in front of them. And this is caused a lot of anger, a lot of fear from the government. I saw many of my friend being disappearing from classroom because they said, one of my classmates when I was in third grade, she said, at that time we were in a war in Iran, and she said, Iran is not that bad. So she disappeared from school with her whole family from the neighborhood.
It sounds like one of your first missions might be to separate school from the agenda of the government.
Definitely. This is something need to happen first thing in terms of if we want to change the education system in there. There is no subject except probably for math or chemistry that they don't have anything associated with the party or with the regime. They need just to have people have decent, normal education.
I want to thank you so much for talking to us.
It's my pleasure, and I hope we can see you sometime in Iraq and we can work with you there.
Zainab Al-Suwaj, Director of the Islamic Congress in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Elephant Walk Restaurant in Porter Square, featuring their innovative menu of Cambodian and French cuisine. Ample complimentary parking available. Menus and reservations at elephantwalk.com. By Innuendo, offering decorative solutions to help meet their clients' needs, featuring shutters in wood or thermalite and silk or sheer panels from around the world. And Afinia Dumont, an executive fit Fitness Suite Hotel in New York, where healthy meets high tech. Information at afinia.com, AFFINIA.com. Later on this hour and here and now, listener poems of serenity. It's 62 and breezy now in Boston under partly sunny skies.
What makes a Citizens of the World Tour special?
We had wonderful meals in exotic places.
It was exciting and it was fun, and we got unbelievable treatment and unbelievable accommodations and food and everything. It was really a great time.
Join Sylvia Pajoli on our next Citizens of the World Tour to Tuscany and Umbria this summer. You'll enjoy stays in the Palazzo Terranova, a beautifully restored villa overlooking the Umbrian countryside, and Siena's luxurious 14th-century Locanda dell'Amorosa, surrounded by its own farmlands, vineyards, and gardens. For more information, call 800-909-9287.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, new federal guidelines mean that millions more Americans find out they now have higher than normal blood pressure.
And remember West Nile disease? One scientist says it could be more of a threat now than SARS.
And our listeners take time out to share their serenity poetry.
My books are still now, hushed shut from last night, and there is one sunbeam idling on the rug.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. A six-member FBI team arrived in Saudi Arabia today to help the Saudis investigate the suicide attacks that killed 34 people this week, including eight Americans. According to a U.S. diplomat, the six agents will aid, not run, the investigation. Officials in Washington say they are purposely keeping FBI teams small to avoid the perception that U.S. law enforcement officials are taking over terrorist investigations in foreign countries. U.S. Civil Administrator Paul Bremer is in Baghdad, and he says he's moving fast to make the streets safe.
We recall that Saddam released some 100,000 prisoners onto the streets last October. Many of these people were political prisoners, but some of them were criminals, violent criminals. It's time these people were put back in jail, and that's where we will put them.
U.S. officials are also asking Iraqis to turn in their guns. And contrary to a New York Times report yesterday, Bremer says troops will not shoot looters on sight. However, he says U.S. soldiers will take action to protect themselves. Attorney General John Ashcroft says two terrorism suspects were trained by Osama bin Laden and had vowed to kill Americans whenever and wherever they could. Ashcroft says a 50-count federal indictment issued in New York charges the two in bombing of the USS Cole Navy destroyer in the year 2000. The suspects remain at large. The Coast Guard has apparently intercepted six Cubans who tried to enter the U.S. on a small boat this morning. Five of the men were plucked from the water near the Florida Keys, including one who treaded water for more than 2 hours. Cubans who reach U.S. soil are typically allowed to stay. Last week, three Cuban migrants swam ashore near Key Largo. President Bush's tax cut proposal is now before the Senate. Republicans say they have enough votes to temporarily end taxes on dividends as part of an economic stimulus package. Senators George Voinovich and Ben Nelson have reportedly agreed to back the measure that would give the GOP 50 votes, and Vice President Dick Cheney would be able to cast the tie-breaking vote. The measure would phase out the dividend tax for 3 years and then reinstate it. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 10 points at 86.58, the Nasdaq is up 3 points at 15.38, and the Standard & Poor 500 is up a fraction at 9.40. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Goldsmiths 3 of Concord, creative contemporary jewelers handcrafting rings and other fine jewelry for engagements, weddings, anniversaries, and all days made special, goldsmiths3.com. By North Hill, a greater Boston life care retirement community in Needham, offering independent living apartments, home health, skilled nursing, and rehabilitation for 18 years. 781-433-6520. And by the restaurant Clio, at the Elliott Hotel, named one of America's 50 best hotel restaurants by Food & Wine magazine 2003. Reservations at ElliottHotel.com. In the forecast today, partly sunny and breezy, high of 64, but cooler along the coast. Cloudy and 44 tonight. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy and cooler in the 50s. It's 62 right now in Boston. And in sports, the Red Sox are hoping for a sweep against the Texas Rangers tonight at Fenway Park.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Here's some news that may raise your blood pressure. If your doctor's lately reassured you about your blood pressure, he or she may have inadvertently offered false comfort. New government standards widen the blood pressure danger zone. Numbers as low as 120 over 80, always considered just fine, may not be so fine after all. Joining us on the line now from New York City is Dr. Aram Chobanian. He's dean of the Boston University Medical School and chair of the government-appointed committee that wrote the new guidelines. Welcome, Dr. Chobanian.
Thank you.
Briefly, doctor, what are the new guidelines? What's normal now for blood pressure?
Well, the new guidelines indicate that normal blood pressures would be less than 120 over 80. Another category has been put into place for individuals who are above 120 over 80 up to 140 over 90, and they're now categorized as being pre-hypertensive.
Meaning?
Meaning that their chances of developing hypertension are very good, and in fact, it's been shown from studies such as our Framingham Heart Study that if you are at age 55 and free of hypertension, your chances of developing high blood pressure during your lifetime is about 90%. And it's also clear that your blood pressure at 140 over 90 imparts twice the risk of heart attack or stroke than a blood pressure of 120 over 80. So I think by keeping the blood pressure down, if you're in this pre-hypertension range, you can prevent, first of all, going to higher levels, but also reduce your risk.
So, Doctor, how many more people are at risk with these new guidelines?
This new category represents approximately 22% of the adult population, or about 46 million individuals. But this is not a crisis situation. It's a way of highlighting a group of individuals who would benefit from healthy lifestyles with respect both to the advancement of their blood pressure with age as well as reducing cardiovascular complications of high blood pressure.
Now, people who discover they have high blood pressure, what should they do?
Well, people with high blood pressure should get it controlled. And the important part of this, if you do have hypertension, you need to be taken care of by your physician, and you need to be either with lifestyle changes. And if that doesn't work enough to lower blood pressure to less than 140 over 90, then to introduce medications. So there shouldn't be anyone around who cannot get their blood pressures lowered.
What sort of lifestyle changes are we talking about for people who may have high blood pressure?
There are several lifestyle changes that can be made. If one is overweight, reducing weight is a very effective approach. And with a 10 to 20 pound reduction in body weight, you can often see a very good reduction in blood pressure. Exercise is helpful. Dietary changes such as using less salt and more fruits, vegetables, grains, those can be quite effective. And if one has excess alcohol consumption, it should be reduced to, say, no more than 2 drinks a day for men and 1 drink a day on the average for women.
Doctor, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Aram Chobanian is dean of the Boston University Medical School. For more information on the new guidelines, check out our website, here-now.org.
The West Nile virus could have a bigger impact than SARS. This according to two Harvard researchers who warn that the mosquito-borne virus that killed 284 people and sickened more than 4,000 in North America last year could now move from the eastern seaboard of the U.S. and attack the drought-stricken plains and western states. Well, joining us in the studio is Dr. Paul Epstein, one of those researchers. He is Associate Director of the Center for Health and the Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. Welcome, Doctor.
Good afternoon, Robin. A pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. And, you know, people are saying, well, SARS prompted health warnings from the World Health Organization. So why haven't we heard about West Nile from them?
Well, SARS is a wake-up call about the force that infectious disease can play in history. Its impacts have gone right to the bank, as it were, with trade, travel, tourism. Nations are in jeopardy.
And you think the same thing can happen with West Nile?
I think that West Nile and SARS, first of all, are part of a group of emerging infectious diseases that have caught us by surprise in public health. Everything was going of chronic disease, heart disease, cancer, stroke in the 60s, 70s. Since the mid-70s, there are 30 diseases new to medicine: Ebola, Legionella, HIV, AIDS, Lyme, now SARS, host of antibiotic-resistant agents. We haven't seen this kind of crossover of bugs from animals to humans in the annals of medicine, and probably since hunters and gatherers became herders and domesticated animals. Mm.
You mentioned some of the reasons that you suspect West Nile might also increase is that there's drought. Now, why would drought lead to mosquito-borne diseases?
Right. Counterintuitive. In the cities, drought is what leads small collections of water in the catch basins on the corner. Collecting litter and also organically rich material is where these bugs, these Culex pipiens that are urban dwellers, breed. Then they bite birds, birds bitten by mosquitoes. You get the cycle revved up in the spring in drought.
Right.
We know this because of all the major outbreaks in cities in Europe in the 90s were related to drought. So drought covered the East Coast in 99, three-week July heat wave, and that's what led to the explosive debut in New York in 99.
Because when there's only a tiny bit of amount of water, like you said, garbage collecting somewhere, that it's a huge concentration of bugs.
Exactly. So what we did not appreciate how rapidly this would spread. In the summer of 2002, warm winter, which is related to climate change, low snowpack in the Rockies, no runoff, drought, severe drought, hard to remember now with this cool, cruel winter we've just gone through. But that set the stage, and this raced ferociously to 44 states, jumped to California, D.C., 5 of the 10 Canadian provinces. This is new. This is a disease of nature, of wildlife, and its impact on birds of prey is a particular concern because the owls eat the mice that carry Lyme ticks or plague or hantavirus.
So as this disease spreads, it just messes with the chain, the natural chain, and keeps wreaking havoc. So what should we do?
The first is the surveillance and response capability that has to be beefed up all over the country, specifically West Nile, mosquitoes and birds.
Mm-hmm.
Second, we need to develop early warning systems based on climate forecasting. But the third is the real preventive upstream measures. And here we're talking about environment and energy policies. And within cities, we need faster flowing, good flowing streams. We need to deal with the energy policies. It is climate change and the associated intensification of extreme weather, these droughts punctuated by heavy rains, that is what's most destabilizing to the biological systems.
Well, Doctor, thank you.
Thank you, Robin. A pleasure.
Dr. Paul Epstein is Associate Director for the Center for Health and the Global Environment at Harvard Medical School.
Still to come, serenity poems for a frenzied world.
You're listening to Here and Now. It's Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Many of you responded to our interview with Scotsman George Galloway, the member of Parliament, kicked out of the Labour Party because of his condemnation of Britain's involvement in the war with Iraq. Susan Anderson of Philadelphia writes, "Bravo! This is the first I've heard of Mr. Galloway. His impassioned and forthright self-defense of his anti-war stance and comments to Parliament makes me even more proud to be just 6.25% Scot."
Dean Stevens of Rosendale, Massachusetts, wrote after hearing our conversation exploring Nicaragua after the ouster of the Sandinistas. Dean writes, "I take issue with your suggestion that democracy came to Nicaragua in 1990. The U.S. anointed candidate Violeta Chamorro to run against the ruling Sandinista party in the kind of U.S. meddling of the sort Bush is now championing in the Middle East."
Well, Matthew QB McDowell sent this criticism after hearing our recent film review of X2, X-Men United. "One of your reviewers said this movie has more depth than one would expect from a film based on a comic book. Comic books are a medium, not a genre, and to assume that they're all disposable superhero adventures is the same as assuming that all television programs are mindless sitcoms."
Responding to Bill's essay about President Bush's highly publicized jet landing aboard an aircraft carrier at a time when millions of Americans are out of work, listener Carol Front writes, "I thought the piece you did on America Out of Work was great. My son-in-law has been jobless since Christmas, and your thoughts really got to the heart of the problem. Keep up the good work."
Thanks, Carol. A lot of the mail we received this week concerned our story about the University of California considering a ban on professors dating students, in which a professor defended his dating of a student who became his wife. But Beth Walters of Charlotte, North Carolina, had a different point of view, and Beth joins us now on the line. Welcome, Beth.
Thank you.
Beth, you felt we missed something with this story. What was that?
It was the issue of power. It's the same reason that relationships between professors and students would be considered unethical if they were relationships between, say, a psychotherapist and a counselee or a clergy person and a parishioner. It's not only an imbalance of power, but it's an abuse of that power. So when Professor so-and-so seems to think that you are smart and witty and sexy, that's heady stuff, especially for a teenager or a 20-something student who's still working out a solid sense of self-worth.
What do you say, Beth, to someone, a professor, who's happily married to a former student of his?
Well, you know, I wouldn't deny that there can be healthy relationships, although in my years on campuses I've been aware of a lot of unhealthy ones. I think they are by far the exception. I know one professor who's been married to, I think it's 5 of his students.
Oh, my gosh. That may argue your case, Beth Walters, and thanks very much for getting in touch with us.
Thank you, Bill.
And finally, some of you asked about the fiddle music we used in our Fiddleheads cooking segment. Well, it came from the trio of John Hartford, Mike Seeger, and David Grisman, and you can find it on the CD Retrograss, but here's a bit more.
As always, we love to hear from you. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your name, phone number, and town.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Landry & Arcari, Oriental Rugs and Carpeting, offering a complimentary brochure filled with pictures and tips on buying rugs and carpeting, 800-649-5909. By Skinner Auctioneers, currently accepting antiques, including furniture, paintings, and jewelry for its summer and fall auction seasons. Auction schedule online at skinner.inc.com, and by Bistro 5 in West Medford Square, featuring eclectic Tuscan cuisine and highlighted in the current Zagat survey titled Spotlight on America's Top Restaurants. For a limited time, you can enter our drawing to win the latest model Subaru. It's the new Baja, courtesy of Cityside Subaru in Arlington. See the new Baja and enter the drawing with your contribution for the news online at WBUR.org. News from the BBC coming up at 1 o'clock, 62 degrees in Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
It's hard to come by, but serenity is not unattainable. Many of you are able to find some peace in your own poems, inspired by Here and Now's roving poets Molly Sicardo and Jim Burley. Well, Jim and Molly are back to share some entries in the Serene Poetry Listener Invitational. And hello to you both. Hi, Robin.
I'm not really feeling that serene, but hi,
you
Robin.
You never are. I don't think you...
What am I doing here?
I know. You're here just to balance Molly and I out.
Yeah.
Wait, Molly, we received so many submissions. Were you surprised?
I wasn't, because I think it's something people need right now so much, and everyone's looking for a little quiet corner or longing for a little quiet corner.
Right. And Jim, listeners found that quiet corner in so many different ways in nature. Yeah, through their children, their grandchildren, animals, music.
There is this one from Massachusetts. Her name is Libby File, and she wrote one called Mount Desert Island. The high keening notes of the bagpipe skirled in the crisp, clean air of beginning of autumn, an oral summary of the wind sweeping along the raw granite face of the mountain. Now, I used to go up with my parents every year to Acadia National Park up in Maine, and that's where Mount Desert Island is. And I remember how serene it is out there with all the trees and stuff like that. And I think Libby here is sort of capturing that, moment in nature.
I can smell that clean air. But Molly, she violated one of your rules, which was not to have cutting sharp words.
She did. But she made the image that worked for Jim, and so that worked very well.
You had said to us that the choice of words really can help if you use mellower words, rounded words, and most people did.
That's true. I really did care about the words. In fact, I just pulled words out of a few of them. Tom Lorenzen from North Carolina used words warm, dusk, stand, and wine. Wine is a really serene word. And Paul Tumarkin used monsoon clouds, which also has a peaceful sound to it.
The poems obviously brought serenity to the writers, but to the reader as well. One in particular, Elizabeth Salpers of Tucson, Arizona. The first line of her poem took us to her front porch, and then that's where she went to read it to us. We called her up, and I asked her, you know, if I could even hear the birds in the background.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm standing literally in my front yard, and we are near a riparian area.
Riparian?
Riparian area, yeah. We have an arroyo that runs in our neighborhood.
What's an arroyo?
An arroyo is actually, it's an area where there's usually a lot of vegetation, and it brings in birds from all over. So it's just a wonderful kind of serene area to be.
Well, what a wonderful insight into desert country.
It is.
And your poem also, it just made me so calm. So, well, it's called Pear Dreams. Let's hear it.
Pear Dreams. From the cool shade of the porch, I toss my half-eaten pear out into the vast landscape of our desert backyard and watch as our border collie snaps for it. It is hers forever. She sends an artful glance to our German shepherd a few feet away, who now can only dream of tasting the sweet, mushy meat and chewing on the small, sunny stem.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for not only sharing that moment that you had, but through your phone call, we feel like we've been, you know, in that serene... Oh, it just sounds beautiful there.
Oh, it is. You know, Tucson is just a wonderful, wonderful haven in the desert.
Well, thanks for sharing it with us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for talking with me.
Just the word Arizona is a serenity poem.
It is, you're right.
One word.
There was a lot of birds there in the back. It was like a Hitchcock movie or something like that. It's like all of the birds in Arizona are in Tucson right now outside
only
of that
you.
Porch.
Yeah,
only you.
Birds can be serene, Jim.
Some people found their serenity in acceptance. Christopher Fletcher of Bristol, Rhode Island, went through a pretty tough experience. I called him, and he told me about the inspiration for his poem.
Well, my son recently was hospitalized. He has muscular dystrophy, and his heart stopped. And we had to make some pretty, you know, heavy decisions about quality of life versus longevity and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and he's 16 years old, so he made a decision of his own.
He did.
What did he decide?
He basically decided that he was going to not accept any intrusive medical procedures into his life.
Mm. Well, your poem is called The Turning.
Right.
Can we hear it?
Sure. Mm-hmm. I know your gentle stare, like light falling from the evening sun, tugging on my wandering eye, to keep me straight upon the darkened road. I know your gentle touch, like cool breath of air upon my skin, refreshing thoughts sent to turn me and keep me safe within the labors of the day. I know your lightness of breath, like softness of summer evenings, clothed in gowns of white upon the wind, to rest my bones upon another day, to keep me safe within the garden walls, and to hold me once more within that silent stair of solitude and mended walls of stone.
Chris, tell us more about this poem, how it came to be and what it says for you.
Well, when I was going through this whole process, what I found was that I needed a way to vent. So I started sending emails to my friends and relatives, and within that process, I started sending poems each day. And what I found was that within, you know, all of this pain, there was a sense of beauty.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for sharing what gave you serenity during that time.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Yeah. By the way, Christopher tells us his son, his 16-year-old son, is doing just fine.
That's great. Okay.
And so is he, with the help of poetry.
Right.
Well, there were so many. Danielle Bernardo Ryan in Blue Point out on Long Island, lucky woman, has a poem which came from a lifelong passion.
I think anybody who's played music in a band or an orchestra and been a part of that coming together of different sounds and different instruments, that's my inspiration.
Yep.
Also, my inspiration comes from the idea of myself as a musician. I haven't played music since I was in high school. I'm 30 years old now. But when I think about things about myself that I like, one of those things is that I played music, and so that is a nice place for me to go to.
Well, you're preaching to the choir because you're talking to a former Long Island choir girl. And this really resonated with me. I know it will with others. Let's hear your poem. It's called Strings.
Okay. There's really only one way to feel hugged by music, to be carried off on a cloud of sound that swirls around you like an audio aurora borealis and allows you to become a part of the symphony, even as it lifts you up to holy places, For me, there was really only one way to celebrate my place in the Grand Philharmonic of existence. Second row, fourth seat, first violin, high school orchestra. Geeks, jocks, popular or not, we found unity in antique songs. We created intangible, exquisite beauty, surely imperfect and better for it, for such is life.
Lovely. Well, thank you, Danielle.
Thank you so much for your time, Robin.
She had some great phrases. Unity and antique songs.
Yeah. And there's more, so let's thank others. Elizabeth Albright from Ferguson, North Carolina, for the pine-scented air. Mm. And Megan Krause from Doylestown, Pennsylvania. He swaddles his loveys in soft, fleecy warmth.
Oh.
You know, little kids wrap up.
Right.
They wrap up their little stuffed things.
The sounds and the images worked really well.
I still do that. That's not just kids.
So you have your serene moments then, too,
yeah,
Jim.
Yeah, sure.
Well, let's leave with one last listener, Otis Reed in Warren, Rhode Island. We'll just hear his poem.
Oh, I like this one.
It's called My Books Are Still Now.
My books are still now, hushed shut from last night, and there is one sunbeam idling on the rug, and hearing, only slight, my first thought, a ripple across this room, before the day, before the cars outside, before the stoves hum and the phone, before the pipes shift and moan, I lie here all okay and wanting nothing, just stay.
First thing in the morning, that first moment in the morning.
Right, that is serene. And the last moment at night, I have one from Sharon Long in Buckingham, Pennsylvania that says, it is a pink and gold day for just a moment.
Wow.
Well, there you go.
Goes either way.
Well, there you go.
You're good at this, Molly.
We want to thank all of our listeners for sharing their serene moments. To view them, you can visit our website, here-now.org. And, Jim, what's the next challenge?
Think bats, gloves, balls, and hot dogs.
And diamonds are a girl's best friend.
What are all those things having gone?
What could that be? Here Now's roving poets, Molly Sicardo and Jim Burley. Thank you both.
Thank you, Robin.
To go do some yoga.
And remember, to read all of our serene poetry, visit our website, here-now.org.
Well, Here and Now is a production of WBUR, Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
WBUR support.
.com.
WBUR support.